From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In the wild, clematis don't have that post holding up your mailbox to support them or a piece of wooden trellis. In nature, they scramble and climb through other plants, which offers us a hint of just how versatile and willing they are, and the many ways to use them in the garden, which is the subject of today's show. First, though, these messages.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/Away to Garden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Today's guest, Linda Buettler, is author of three books about clematis and president of the International Clematis Society and curator of the Rogerson Clematis Collection in the Pacific Northwest, just outside Portland, Oregon. Suffice it to say, Linda knows from clematis, and I'm so pleased she's made time to speak with us. Welcome, Linda. I'm so glad you're here. We need help. We need help.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Yes. One of the favorite plants, I think, of many, many gardeners. I was interested to read, I believe you're the first American president of the International Clematis Society. Is it usually all Brits or what?
We do have a lot of British members, lots of German members. We've had presidents from Sweden and Poland. And we have lots of members in Japan, where clematis are quite widely bred. So, yeah, we're pretty far flung.
Truly international. Well, congratulations on being the president. And the collection that you curate at the Rogerson Clematis Collection, tell us a little bit about that, how big it is and what it's like.
I was just messing around in the accessions records yesterday. We have 1,802 plants.
Wow.
And 789 different varieties and species of clematis.
That's a lot. Did you know that that's a lot? That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. It does sound like a lot, but when you consider that there are something like 60,000 different varieties of daylilies in the trade available from year to year, we're just pikers. We're just getting started.
Well, on the other hand, we could look at it that the clematis people are more discerning, couldn't we? That you've been more discerning in naming things that are truly distinctive and different from one another. That's how I'm going to look at
it. Yeah, I think we have a lot of breeders who are not always trying to reinvent the wheel.
Right. So now, at Rogerson, is it a garden? I mean, you just talked about the, you know, accession records and, you know, that it's this massive collection. What is it when I come to it, if I come to it? What is it?
The place where we're located is called Lusher Farm, and it's a decommissioned dairy farm that the city of Lake Oswego bought. It's part of their parks and recreation system, and we lease 2 acres from them, and we have our office there. So part of our garden wraps around an old farmhouse that was built in 1900, and there's a barn, big, wonderful barn that is our backdrop, and then we have a series of themed gardens. We have a front bank that's very hot, where the clematis that like it really hot are. People hear feet in the shade, head in the sun, and that's true mostly. Mm-hmm. But like all generalizations, there are exceptions. And so we have a place for hot things. We have a place for Brewster Rogerson's favorites. Sometimes the plants are divided up geographically. Some plants are that all like sort of the same climate are put together, even though we're not that climate.
Mm-hmm.
And we have troughs, we have clematis in sort of elevated rock gardens where they have really good drainage when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the clematis are grown with companion plants,
mm-hmm.
because we want people to encourage people to add clematis to their gardens.
Mm. So it's kind
so
of
so we're leading yeah. we're leading by example.
So there's inspiration, then ideas, as well as just the collection that we could come through and say check things off the list, so to speak.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I learned in your book, I think it's your most recent book, The Plant Lover's Guide to Clematis, which, in the name of full disclosure, I'll say is published by one of our program sponsors, Timber Press. I learned what your favorite clematis is, which is no mean feat having a favorite because, as you just said, there are a lot of clematis to choose from. I learned that yours and mine are the same. Now, how weird is that since we don't know each other?
Oh, that's great.
Is it Venosa violacea? Is that how we say it? How do we
right.
say it? Yeah, it's the striped
one. That's
exactly
one. Right. yeah, you know, before I became curator long, long ago, when I first started collecting clematis myself, I saw a picture of that plant, and I thought, nothing could be that beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I finally got it, and it's been my favorite all along, all these years. But when I'm at the clematis garden as the curator, I try not to have favorites.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. You're open-minded, and you're fair to all your charges. Okay.
I try to be.
Yeah. Well, I have it when you walk into my garden. It's the first plant on your left as you enter at the top of the driveway and come into the actual garden. And it's growing, as it has for many, many years, through a very, very old, like a 30-year-old Corylopsis spicata, a spike winter hazel.
Oh, nice.
And the winter hazel is probably 20, 25 feet across and maybe 8 feet tall and gnarly and crazy, you know, with wacky arms. And then this thing is like scrambling through it. And it's fun. And it's just a fun plant. And we'll show a picture of it with the transcript of the show. But speaking of combining, I saw on the Rogerson Clematis Collection website about you and the talks you give, and that you give one called Shall We Dance? Clematis Make Great Partners. And
that's a brand new talk that actually I'm still putting together. I'm going to give it in April for the Northwest Horticultural Society up in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
So they wanted me to do something new.
Uh-huh.
And so I have a real passion for combining these plants. I just love it. It's so much fun to place these plants in the garden and to think about combining them both with color and chronologically. You know, when are they going to bloom?
Right.
What are their partners going to be? Or am I going to do something like you've done, which Corylopsis spicata is beautiful. In fact, this time of year, it's just coming into its own, and the clematis won't be in bloom for another 2 or 3 months at
least.
Good point,
yes.
So you're using the clematis to give you color where there will not be color in the summer.
Right. And I do the same in reverse thing with my, I have a lot of Ilex verticillata, the winterberry, the native winterberry to the east. And those look great in fruit, you know, in the fall and early winter until all the birds eat them. But I have clematis through a lot of them, like, and I can't say the name of this one, Cheesonensis, lemon bells. I know the cultivar name. Now, how do you say the species of that?
Well, actually,
does
if
it renamed?
We want to be right up to the minute, it's now Clematis coriana var carunculosa lemon bells.
Oh, forget about it. Coriana sounds like it comes from Asia.
Sorry,
to me.
I had to, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, clematis are as heir to the whimsies of the taxonomists as anybody else.
Right.
And
So lemon bells, little yellow lemon bells, and so they do
Let's
their thing.
Let's just call it lemon bells.
So they do their thing earlier, and then I have the fruit of the ilex later, and there you go. That's, again, like what you're saying. So tell us, give us sort of some other sneak peek ideas, maybe starting from the lower level up to the higher levels, of some of the things that might be in this Shall We Dance kind of a talk, some other examples that we can use in our yard.
Well, a lot of garden designers think of the garden in layers, starting with sort of the ground cover layer and then your herbaceous perennials and shorter shrubs,
mm-hmm.
and then you get up into the taller shrubs and the trees. And so that's another way to approach adding clematis to the garden. So at the ground level, you've got the herbaceous perennial clematis. There are such things. There are clematis that don't climb.
Love them.
And the other great thing about them is that We have a lot of herbaceous perennials that we use in our garden that will rebloom. Mm-hmm. And the herbaceous perennial clematis are really good rebloomers. If you keep them deadheaded, or you can just go out in the middle of the summer, chop them off at the ground, and they'll be reblooming by the time you get into September. So anybody that's got a long growing season should be starting at the ground level with the herbaceous perennial clematis. Some of those are a little short erect plants. Some of them tend to be a little floppier.
Okay.
Because they've taken these herbaceous perennials and crossed them with the vines, but the gene for not climbing is very dominant, so you end up with a big floppy herbaceous perennial.
Mm-hmm.
But those are great to go into your hydrangeas and your roses, and because they don't cling, they don't hang on, it's really easy to get under your shrubs. You cut these guys off as soon as they're dormant, and you can just pull the foliage out of the shrub without having to prune the shrub or breaking up the shrub. And then Raymond Evison over on the island of Guernsey has done a lot of breeding with clematis that are actually vines but don't get very tall.
Okay.
So that's another way to get clematis into the mid-zone. And then you can use your higher ones, taller clematis, to get into trees and so forth.
So, for instance, if we're talking about making these good matchups, we wouldn't want to take a sort of really, I would say rampant, but that maybe is a negative word, like a Clematis montana that grows a lot, I think. You wouldn't put that on a small shrub like I was talking about before, correct? You wouldn't overwhelm.
Right. You really have to pair, you have to do a little research and, you know, read your plant tags and see what the maximum height is, and generally it's a truism that the clematis is going to get to its mature size before any shrub or small tree you're going to put it in.
Yes.
With the montanas, I really try to get people to use them like a festoon on, like, balconies.
Yes.
That sort of thing, where they're actually supported by something that isn't living.
A pergola.
Because the clematis montanas can get really heavy.
Yes.
And here in the Pacific Northwest and the Maritime Northwest, people love the Clematis armandii, the evergreen clematis that flower in March. And even those, they get huge. And so in the international clematis world, we're really thinking right now and having a lot of conversations and meetings about how we talk about pruning to people who don't know clematis really well.
So we're going to get to that in a minute, because I know that's one of the things you have to enlighten us about. But I want to just, before we prune them, I want to just double back to the non-vining ones now. So I have, say, like Clematis recta and Clematis recta purpurea. I think it's a named one, like Lime Close or something. So I think of those as non-vining. Is that what you're talking about? Give us a couple of other examples of those so people can...
Right. Those are great examples.
Okay.
There are a couple of really popular cultivars. There's Arabella that has
beautiful.
A real sky blue flower. And she's a cross between Clematis integrifolia, which is a charming little Northern Asia, Northern Europe herbaceous perennial plant. Has a little four-petaled bell, basically shades of blue. There are also some other variations in the wild that have been used in cultivation. And it only gets 18 inches tall.
Okay.
And it's the real founding parent for Arabella, her sister Miranda, and Clematis durandii, which is another really popular one. Those are names that people are going to see.
Okay, thank you.
Clematis recta is also native to Eastern Europe, and if you look at where these plants are native to, it'll tell you what their hardiness is.
Right. Well, I'm a zone 5, and I've been growing that for eons and eons and eons. I have numbers of plants, and it's gotten to be quite a lusty creature. It's massive.
Yeah.
But I love the purple one. Yeah, I love the purple foliage of the purple one.
Yeah, the purpurea, and Lime Close is not lime green. It's named for the nursery where it was discovered, called Lime Close.
Right.
And it comes out of the ground, this deep, chocolatey purple
it's
color.
It's unreal. Yeah.
And if you have a long enough growing season that when it's done flowering, you can cut it back to the ground. The new growth is purple every time it comes out of the ground.
I am so grateful for that tip because, you know, I've had it probably 20 years and I didn't know that. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. So it will come, every time it comes back, it's that dark purple color again. And then you've probably noticed that it goes towards green as it gets towards flowering.
Yes.
And then once it's done flowering, say about Bastille Day or so, middle of July, you can cut it right back to the ground. And then as you go into the autumn, it'll come back up. It'll be dark purple again, and it will rebloom, but it won't get as tall.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited. I'm going to get, like, triple dip out of this one plant that I've known only one way for all these years. So, excellent.
There you go.
So, sort of in that middle height, because I think that's what a lot of us have in our gardens. We have a lot of shrubs more than we want to have something to grow up a giant tree. What are some of the other, some of the sort of intermediate ones that you want to make us look
well,
for?
Well, that's where a lot of people use the large flowered hybrids.
Okay.
And some of the large flowered hybrids can be sort of rangy, meaning mm-hmm. they want to put on 6 or 8 feet of growth before they even think about flowering. And those are actually kind of nice to put into shrubs because you sort of don't notice they're there until they work their way to the surface. And we have she's passed away now, but a local garden writer named Delcy Mahar mm-hmm. had the most wonderful combination in her garden of an ember glow, really reddish pink hydrangea with a wonderful stalwart mid-century clematis called Rouge Cardinal, or Red Cardinal, sometimes you'll see it. But it was just this lovely combination because the pink was really rich and then the clematis was this really velvety textured plant when it was in bloom. So you have these, you know, the mop heads with the clematis. So you can play with texture as well as color. And that's a clematis that really, it wants to go. It's a plant that it's hard for nurseries to sell because their nurseries are timid about cutting it back to keep it under control in the nursery because they know that they've got to let it go some to bloom.
Right, because vine nurseries can get to be a messy place if millions of vines.
I'm actually preparing some talks to give at symposia that are retail nursery, trade shows to talk about really what they can best do to be selling customers the best possible clematis plant. Mm. And it isn't always let the thing bloom.
Right.
Not every flower bud is sacred, and the root system is a whole lot more important, and the number of shoots is more important than is it in bloom when you buy it.
So speaking about maybe sometimes when things need a haircut, let's talk about, you alluded to it before, and I said, wait a minute, because I wanted more good clematis names first. But this whole, we've all been taught the type 1, type 2, type 3, according to when the plants bloom, the clematis are divided up according to their bloom time. And from there, we're supposed to extrapolate how and when to prune them. And that sort of works. But I understand from you that there's some evolving thinking about that. Can you clue us in a little bit?
Right. The first thing that any gardener needs to worry about with their clematis is pruning for the health of the plant.
Right.
And if you have just one or two stems coming out of the ground and this whole great mass of top growth, you have a lot riding on those few little stems. So it really is long-term the best thing to get rid of those big snarls when the plant is dormant.
Okay.
And I'm always encouraging people, and especially our new, whenever we have new volunteers at the garden, don't be timid if you're going to prune. And some people deadhead and to get the clematis back into bloom more quickly. And I always say, you know, that's a great time when you're deadheading to also be sculpting, to be thinking about, you know, the plant has flowered in May or June. I'm going to go out and take the flowers off of it and take another foot or two or three off of the plant at that point. And don't be shy. about pruning. Because really the only way to kill a clematis by pruning is if you just prune so often that it never gets to leaf out.
Right. No photosynthesis means a dead plant eventually. Right.
Right. But as far as, well, do I prune it in the fall or do I prune it in late winter, there's really not much difference, because pruning in and of itself in the winter, when the nights are cold and the days are short, clematis aren't stupid, and they know they're not supposed to grow then.
Okay.
So really, as soon as they go dormant in the autumn, if you've got a lot of vine that you want to take back and you don't want to look at it all winter, cut it back.
Mm-hmm.
And with the herbaceous perennial forms, of course, that woody growth might seem pretty stout, but it's not going to come back.
Right.
The new shoots are going to come from the base. So you can go ahead and a lot of these plants you can clean up in the fall.
Okay.
But I think the group, the traditional pruning group that has always bugged me the most is group one, because people see that and they think it means these are clematis that shouldn't be pruned.
Mm.
And there are no clematis that shouldn't be pruned at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think about what you want the clematis to do. And, for instance, the evergreen clematis, the Armandiis and their snowdrift and apple blossom, and you probably can't grow them. I would assume you couldn't.
I don't think so.
But on the coast, on either coast and along the south, they're grown quite a lot. And they get heavy.
Right.
And, you know, the canes get really thick and woody. And you have to prune it some, unless you've got a really stout, you know, balcony that you're growing this thing onto. You really should be pruning it back. And you can prune it back quite hard if you do it when it's done blooming.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has the whole growing season to recover, because this is a plant that flowers in March and April. Then you cut it back as much as you need to, and it's got all summer and fall to recover. And so it's a timing thing.
Okay.
But still, I wouldn't ever say to somebody, never prune it.
Right.
Because that's a recipe for disaster.
Right. So we want to apply. The groups and everything can be informative, but we don't want to follow a rigid system at the expense of having some, as you say, some creature with two spindly, crazy stems that are 6 feet tall and nothing else going on.
Right.
So we want to also look at the structure, the armature that's been being created for this plant to thrive. Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when
okay.
people go to a nursery to buy clematis, they should be looking at the base of the plant.
Right.
They should see a few roots coming out the drainage hole.
Right.
And they should see at least two shoots and hopefully more.
Okay.
And then another piece of advice that I have for people is when you go to plant your clematis, if it's a really wild tangle that the nursery has just sort of let go,
mm-hmm.
then it really should be cut back a little bit. You don't want to take all the leaves off of it when you go to plant it. But if it's in a gallon-sized pot with a hardwood stake that's actually affixed to the pot, which is, I think, what people usually see.
Yes.
Cut the plant back to the top of that post.
Okay.
It reduces transplant shock. It makes it easier to get it in and out of the pot and into the ground. And it just encourages the plant to root out faster and to put up more shoots.
Right.
More quickly.
Makes sense.
So
makes
I always sense. Recommend a little bit of pruning, or a lot, depending on the condition of the plant when you buy it.
Okay.
But when it goes in the ground.
Okay. Well, Linda Buettler, author of The Plant Lover's Guide to Clematis, which we're going to have a book giveaway along with a transcript on awaytogarden.com, and president of the International Clematis Society and curator at Rogerson Clematis Collection. I hope you'll visit us again and keep us taking better care of our clematis and pairing them creatively. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I was delighted to be invited on the show.
Talk to you soon again.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. Or Facebook.com/AwayToGarden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.